Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today, some more selections from the 2004 documentary, The End of Suburbia. Last week, we heard some convincing arguments that all hydrocarbon energy has peaked and will only get harder to extract and more expensive as time goes on. Gasoline, natural gas, heating oil, and therefore electricity too. Today, we'll hear more about the likely consequences. Political posturing, political repression, many oil wars, phony solutions such as hydrogen and biofuels, corporate media that won't even bring up the problem. Speaking of oil wars, the documentary's predictions are spot on. When the film was made in 2004, the U.S. had waged war on oil-rich Iraq and on Afghanistan, gateway to the oil-rich Caspian Basin. Since it was made, we have waged war on oil-rich Libya and begun low-scale wars against oil-rich Sudan and oil-rich Iran. But it's not all gloom and doom. We'll also hear some steps that will help us. Replace suburban sprawl with the new urbanism. Revitalize towns as well as cities. Relocalize everything. Kiss globalization and Walmart goodbye. So the future, in some ways, sounds pretty good. Many voices speak. Today we'll hear a lot from urban planner James Howard Kunstler, environmentalist Richard Heinberg, and political analyst Michael Ruppert. Let's start with Richard Heinberg.
Consequences of global oil peak for the average family may not be immediately apparent. Because energy prices and the economy are so closely intertwined, that would probably result in an economic recession. The underlying direction of events would be toward decreased economic activity because there would be less energy available to fuel economic activity. And people would be wondering why we're in recession after recession and why every recession seems to be a little bit worse than the last one. And it takes longer to get out of it. And then we never quite get out of the recession until finally it would come to the point after a few years where the recession would turn into really an economic depression. And in this case, it will be one that never ends.
Those who've been born in or moved to suburbia tend to feel that there's a birthright to the lifestyle they enjoy. There's the three-car garage, the large lawn, the even larger house. Consumption of resources is just something you take for granted and you pay a bill for monthly. That will change, and that will be a jarring change when it comes. It will feel like an ambush.
I think we will see a lot of denial. I think we will see, particularly when imminent natural gas catastrophes happen, when we see natural gas prices go up 10 times in the course of a month, by a multiple of 10. And we see gasoline prices go to $4 a gallon. You know, we'll see all these rationales to blame somebody else.
Their immediate natural gut reaction will be that they've been gypped by somebody, they've been ripped off by the oil companies. They will smell some kind of conspiracy that somebody's to blame all for this. And when people feel themselves defrauded or conspired against, they often overreact. So you could even see sort of violent scenes around filling stations in suburban America. Simply because the unfortunate people have not been properly told.
Suburbia has very poor prospects for the future. But unfortunately, so many generations of Americans are now used to it, and it has become so normal that there's going to be a tremendous struggle to maintain it against all the terrible events that are coming down at us. And I think what you'll see is an attempt in North America to maintain the entitlements of suburbia long after the world has made it clear that you just simply can't continue living that way.
Oil depletion and the price of oil increase will have a devastating effect on those communities, which will translate into political upheavals because I think because it is people in these sprawling suburbs who carry a disproportionate weight in American elections. This will create tremendous pressure on politicians to solve the problem somehow by procuring more petroleum some way. I don't think there's a solution to this, but it will create tremendous stress on the political system.
James Howard Kunstler.
I think that Americans will elect maniacs who promise to allow them to keep their McMansions and their housing and their commutes and their suburbs and their big box stores, no matter what the, you know, what historical events have to say about it. And that's going to produce a lot of political friction, I think, probably a lot of violence, probably a threat to our democratic institutions, and it will call into question whether or not we can continue this project of civilization in the context of a democratic republic. You know, I'm not saying that there's going to be a dark age, but I do see a lot of potential for darkness. There's going to be a great scramble out there to get out of the suburbs. There's going to be a sort of fight over the table scraps of the 20th century out there. I use the term cluster to describe what we're heading into. I think that the suburban destiny is a pretty hopeless situation. And I think it's going to be a big mess. It's going to be a political, economic, and social storm. And we're not prepared for it. And, you know, I use that term because it shocks people. But I use it because I think people need to be shocked into the awareness that we got to start preparing for a real problem.
I think there's a great deal of natural resistance at the political level to trying to communicate anything to consumers, voters, about a need to change lifestyles.
Where's the media in all this? Why are why is the American public not being clued in or educated or informed? Well, that's really an amazing, baffling mystery.
I thought I told you to kill that story. It'll cost us a lot of advertising.
If that story goes out, I quit.
All right.
The media are silent on the subject of depletion, energy resource depletion, because there's no upside for them. If they decide to tell the people of North America that, in fact, we are running out of the very resources that fuel economic growth, well, does that make anybody's stock price go up except for a few tiny niche companies that make solar panels and wind turbines?
The major media have been staggeringly irresponsible about this. And, you know, it may be because the attention span of the people in the media is as short as the attention span of the American public. They are the American public, after all, you know. It's just bewildering and mystifying. The hardest thing to accomplish right now is to get America's attention away from, you know, recreational shopping at the mall and Jennifer Lopez and playing computer games and NFL football and NASCAR and all their other current preoccupations.
Reality is bad for business. What's good for business is the fantasy.
We're happily existing in that bubble of the consensus trance, the idea that everything's okay and everybody agrees that everything's okay.
The coming global oil crisis is very, very bad news. Yet the facts of oil depletion have been glaringly absent from the media. Few of us are aware of the extent to which our lives depend on cheap fossil fuels, and we have not been prepared for the shocks the coming crisis will bring. We are a society addicted to oil, and we don't want to hear that it's going to run out.
The title of tonight's presentation is America Running Out of Gas? We are making decisions now in our lives, and decisions are being made for us that will determine the fate of future generations. We are living in the age of the greatest empire the world has ever seen. And it is an empire of oil.
Where is the oil that's left? We've heard it three or four times tonight. 60% of all the recoverable oil on the planet is in the Persian Gulf.
And so comes the Carter Doctrine in 1979, which says that the oil in the Middle East is of strategic importance to the U.S., and we will use our military to defend our access to it.
The world is already in a position where we are not fighting over major oil reserves, we're fighting over scraps.
Enter the neocons. They have a plan. It's a plan, in fact, for world domination. They make no secret out of it. You can read it in the documents widely available on the internet, including from their own websites, the Project for the New American Century. The domination of the world will first require the domination of the planet's dwindling energy resources. Iraq was intended as the opening act in a general reshaping of the Middle East and Central Asia. We've been told by our president and vice president to expect war for the remainder of our lifetimes.
The U.S. would not be in Iraq if that country didn't have oil. The only interest of the U.S. in the Middle East is oil.
Certainly from a military standpoint, we are witnessing a sequential war to control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet. That's the war that will not end in our lifetimes.
I think this war in Iraq was really what stimulated everybody's interest in this subject. Ironically, it did a bit of good, you could say, in that regard, because people would say, why the hell would you want to invade Iraq unless it had a critical role in oil? And it's now evident these weapons of mass destruction don't exist and never did exist, so there has to be some other reason.
The United States must deny any possible competitor on the world stage from controlling the resources.
Afghanistan and Iraq are the two opening engagements in what are bound to be a long series of wars and international contests over the remaining oil in the world. And over 60% of that oil is located in places where people don't like us very much. What we're doing now is that, you know, we're expending a lot of money and energy in the direction of securing those overseas oil supplies. Can we control the pipelines and the wellheads and the refineries? I doubt it. All it takes is 5 pounds of plastic explosive and a camel to put down an oil refinery.
We're spending $50 billion a year in other countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and so on, already, and then add to that tens of billions of dollars for Iraq. This starts to add up. This is having a tremendous drag effect on the U.S. economy, resulting in increasing government debt, both domestic and foreign debt. Then, of course, there's the cost in human life, Americans coming home in body bags. Then there's the cost in American civil liberties. The American people are not going to sit back and watch this foreign policy of occupation and invasion continue indefinitely. And so there's going to be more and more dissent. So how is the government going to deal with dissent? Well, already we see there have been laws put in place like the U.S. Patriot Act, so-called, which significantly erode constitutional protections for freedom of speech and an assembly and privacy. Are these going to be used against average Americans who simply decide to voice their disgust with U.S. foreign policy? I think that's entirely likely.
You will see a lot more global conflict. You will see a draft reinstituted in the U.S., and you will see lots of protests. You'll see lots of young men and women dying overseas in conflict. This is the infinite war.
As this game of musical chairs unfolds across the planet, the Department of Defense put out the notice asking for volunteers to serve on selective service draft boards. You think Cheney was kidding when he said a war that won't end in our lifetimes? Do you think Cheney was kidding when he said this is going to be the biggest conflict that we've ever seen? It's happening.
Okay, so what's the alternative? Surely we can get our energy from some source other than fossil fuels. If we had 50 years to say, well, in 50 years we can get 25% of our energy, yes, that would be quite realistic. But 50 years from now, no. 10 years from now, no. 5 years from now, we'll be past the oil production peak and we'll be needing much more than that.
There's no combination of so-called alternative fuels that are going to allow us to run what we're running in the United States the way we're running it now on oil and natural gas. No amount of solar or wind or even nuclear is going to allow us to continue living this way of life. Now, a lot of people think that hydrogen is going to rescue us. And I think hydrogen is an interesting example of a kind of a public delusion, the kind of delusion that arises when people start to feel frightened. And they have reason to be frightened because we don't have a plan B.
People need to ask very serious questions about alternative energy before jumping into a lifeboat that they have no idea whether it's going to float or not. And we see a whole bunch of almost hysterical applause for hydrogen. Hydrogen is a joke. It is a myth. We will not have a hydrogen economy. Hydrogen is not a form of energy. It's a form of energy storage. And all hydrogen now is produced from some other substance which requires the input of energy.
Generally, it takes more energy to make hydrogen than you get from the hydrogen.
It's fabulous because you only have to have electricity and water. Well, to have electricity, you have to have some other form of energy. The single easiest way to create hydrogen is using methane. Methane is just a scientific term for natural gas. So in a world that we're short of natural gas, the last thing we need is a brand new user.
Hydrogen is tremendously problematical as an element. It's very hard to transport it.
Advocates of compressed hydrogen say, well, I can get a 300-mile range on a car with 190 gallons of compressed hydrogen in a vehicle. I say, great. Who's going to do the crash tests on that? You also have to look at infrastructure requirements. 600 million internal combustion powered vehicles on the planet, 200 million in the United States. People say, we'll just go to hydrogen cars. Who's going to build the hydrogen cars? Somewhere around 90 barrels of oil goes into the energy to make one car. Who's going to pay for the factories? Where's the capital for the factories? Where are the filling stations?
We're just going to take everything we're running now on oil, and we're just going to change it out, and we'll run it on hydrogen instead. Not going to happen that way.
Net energy. Energy return for energy invested. And people just don't think about this. If you're converting biomass into diesel, how much energy went into creating that biomass? If it's plant mass, how much fertilizer, oil, water went into creating that? You have to complete the full equation from start to finish. Ethanol is a net energy loser. It takes more gasoline to create and fertilize the corn and to convert it to alcohol than you get from burning it.
It's mathematically and agriculturally impossible. There isn't enough land to do it. Even if we were happy, as we unfortunately are, to turn it over entirely to corn ethanol, we then probably wouldn't have much, possibly no land left for growing our food.
And as you think these problems through, as we've been doing it from the wilderness, you see that there is nothing, there is no combination of anything that will allow planet Earth to continue consuming the way it does and go on our merry way.
There are no easy or quick fixes for our oil dependency. There are no affordable, scalable alternatives. Yet the political will to address oil depletion does not yet exist. We do have one surplus, and that is a surplus of ideas about how to meet the challenges of living with less oil. Some of those ideas are coming from a movement called New Urbanism. It advocates, quite simply, a return to more traditional, walkable communities.
The New Urbanism was a reform movement in town planning and civic design and architecture. That started in the late 80s among a group of young architects and planners
who realized that we were reaching a dead end with the suburbanization of America, and they sort of looked back on history and the way human beings had done things in the past, and they concluded that there was a great deal of benefit for us in relearning the principles of town planning that had been thrown in the garbage since World War II by the traffic engineers and all the people who have been putting together our everyday world.
Ironically, new urbanists have been now criticized heavily for being historicist and back to the future and all the rest of that, and I don't think that's at all the case. I mean, you have to pick up the threads of culture and history and carry them forward. But carrying them forward is the challenge of new urbanism. That's the new in new urbanism.
First, we have to just revive the idea that the town and the neighborhood and the city can be a wonderful place. And I think the new urbanists have been very successful in beginning that process.
Traditional American town and the great American city were fabulous forms of urbanism. Even though we stole a lot of European architecture, the ultimate form, the classic American grid, both at the city scale and at the village scale, is pretty unique. It's just trashy, the kind of environments that we're creating. When we compare them to what we used to build, it's tragic.
Energy investment banker Matthew Simmons.
Great crises, by definition, are problems that got ignored until they were enormous problems. And I think we have a great crisis coming in energy. What I'm most worried about is how long we've left even addressing the issue. And the longer we ignore the issue, the more painful the problem will become. If you start appreciating how finite and fragile the use of energy is, there's small things that can be done. Can any individual solve the problem? No. It takes a massive collective wake-up.
The crux of the issue, I think, for most ordinary people is we're going to have to live more locally. And we're going to have to at least prepare mentally to do that. You know, ask yourself, you know, what kind of job am I going to have in 10 years? You know, I'm thinking about that myself. You know, I'm an author, but I depend on the trade publishing industry to do my thing. You know, the trade publishing industry might not exist in 10 years the way it has been. You know, it's occurred to me that I would start a local newspaper.
Luckily, technology has really allowed a lot of people, if they wanted to probably work at home.
Find a way to live with fewer car trips, with less driving, becoming less car dependent if you possibly can. Because believe me, we're going to have to do that in the future.
Start paying attention to how you use energy. Pay attention to the fact that energy costs were too cheap, and they need to be a lot more expensive.
One of the most common themes that I've heard, which I really think would be a good outcome of peak oil, is that I'm 52, my parents were raised in the Depression, is that there was a strong sense of neighborhood and a sense of community, that there was a sense of local place that will be an inevitable outcome of peak oil, with a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth and a lot of tantrum throwing. But I think people will learn how to become neighbors again. That may be a good thing for suburbia.
What we will end up doing is creating a lot more localized creation of energy sources. So that if you have an energy problem, it's the problem for your village versus the problem for one-third of the United States.
Alternative energies are going to be, at best, small lifeboats made available in local communities by people who say, nobody's going to do this for me. We have to do it for ourselves. We have to get solar in our neighborhood to wire our apartment right now. We have to spend whatever it takes because the grid's going to go down. We have to find ways to create biodiesel in our own community. Peak oil is going to reverse globalization. Survival will happen from a local basis, and we're going to see local economies. That's the only way the human race is going to survive.
Somehow or another, out of all these great problems comes some great ingenuity. And I think that, you know, we'll probably look back 20 years from now and say, look at all the new things we developed as we basically got serious about our energy problems.
And on that cautiously optimistic note from Matthew Simmons, we'll end our selections from The End of Suburbia. The moral of the story, cheap energy is gone. no new huge source of cheap energy is on the horizon. So, American life as we know it is unsustainable. If we blindly try to continue our ways, the future will be a nightmare. Or we can return to the more localized cities, towns, and farmlands that served us well two generations back. Shop on Main Street. Work near where you live. Walk or bicycle to lots of places. Get your groceries from local farms, not from Mexico and China. Bye-bye McMansions, bye-bye Walmart, bye-bye globalization. Can we pull it off? I have my doubts, but there can be attractive parts to a reduced energy vision of America. Thanks for listening to New World Notes. You'll find some nice links and an archive of past shows on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. You'll get to my non-carborundum and, as for globalization, suburban sprawl, and mile after mile of freeway, let's kiss them goodbye. Ciao.